Good morning, everybody. My mic is working now. Yesterday, as I was thinking about this service and my sermon, I was also thinking about everything else that was going on in my life, and I took myself out to Arastradero Preserves and was walking through the woods in the gently drizzling rain. And I thought my heart was open, and I thought I was being receptive to all that God had to give me in preparation for today. And as I made my way up the path on this journey that I already knew about, it was my favorite little hike, and it takes me up to a meditation point, and there's a bench, and I had it all planned out. I came to the first turn in the road, and there was a chain across it, and it said, "Ye who enter here will pay $250 in a fine." And I thought, oh no. And I spent a few moments kind of bemoaning the fact that my plans weren't going to go as well as I thought they should. But I turned around, and as I was coming back down, I realized in an instant that I had been given a second chance to really be receptive. Because I don't know what happened. I had my hood over my head, so I didn't have a whole lot of vision. But something caught my eye. And as I looked from the path across a gully to a gently upward slope, I noticed a deer. And the deer was gazing at me ever so sweetly and purely and contemplatively. Not a movement of fear. Or you know how frisky they can get and how alert and that you think they're going to run off any moment? Not this one. And I looked at that deer and I thought, oh, she's beautiful. And then I noticed that about 9 yards away was another deer, just under a tree, sheltering from the rain. And then I thought, wow. And then I really began to notice. And there were 7 deer separated by 9 yards apiece, you know, about a half a city block, I'd say, in that one moment of time, all looking at me, just communing with me. And I stood there and drank it in, and I thought, oh, dear. How many opportunities do we waste as we're moving through life at such a fast pace? I know that on my plate right now, as the director of the school, I have the school play that's coming up, and the children are singing for the Dalai Lama in a couple of weeks in Santa Clara, and there are all these logistics, and there's buses, and there are kids who want to be on stage and kids who don't want to be on stage, and it's something. And yet, as I navigate through it, just like on that path, I try to remind myself that if I can get to that point where I can be centered and peaceful and open, who knows how many other deer I will see in my life and in what guise. Now, life gives us challenges, and children are a wonderful template for what faces us because they are who they are and they respond in the moment. And I'm in opposition to that beautiful, tranquil moment up on the trail. Last week, I had a little boy who came to school, and his mother pulled up. They usually pull up. The kids get out. They get their backpacks. They go into the classroom, and the parents drive on. But this little boy was having none of it that day, and he was in a first-class tantrum. I'd never seen it like that. Usually, he gets out, and he goes, "Good morning, Helen," and he's ready for the day. But not this day. And his mother made the decision that he wasn't going to win. So she literally, physically got him out of the car, and he's kicking and screaming, and she's saying, "You are going to school." And she brings him to the door, opens the door, and the teacher's there. And Maria, teacher Maria, takes him and gives him a great big bear hug. And the door closes. And then the mother turns to me and she says, "It was all about rain boots." And she says, "He wanted to wear his rain boots, and we couldn't find them. It wasn't raining," because this is before it started to rain. And we were late. So we had to get in the car and come to school. And she said, you know, what else could I do? I said, in the meantime, I'm thinking to myself, I didn't tell her this, that I understand the magnetism of rain boots for kids. I remember one time, many, many years ago, I was a little older than this little boy, and my mother had taken us out shopping for school. So part of that shopping was preparing for the wet days, and I got this pair of really beautiful patent leather rain boots. And you couldn't wear rain boots unless it was raining. That was the deal. It wasn't part of the dress code. So I waited for it to rain. And we must have had a drought that year, because I don't think it was maybe Thanksgiving when we got the first. And I remember going out and getting all the comments, because these really were exceptional rain boots, and going through the puddles with complete indifference to the water, just the sheer joy of it. So part of me was with that little boy. And then, of course, as a mother, I know, you know, when you want to just, you want divine intervention to deal with your kids. So later on that day, teacher Maria came to me and she says, you know what happened around this little boy? I said, no. She said, he came in, I held him for about 20 minutes, and then he got interested in the story that we were telling, and he joined the circle, and he was just as good as gold the rest of the day. But in the middle of the afternoon, out of nowhere, he looked up at me and he said, Maria, I don't know what that was all about. Out of the mouth of babes, you see. Because isn't that the truth? In our own lives, we go along on these paths, on our daily jobs. And then we get caught up and we get in reaction instead of in reception to whatever is supposed to have. And in that state of high reactivity, we just lose sight of everything. We become unreasonable, right? And we miss out on all those possibilities, those seven beautiful deer that gave me a second chance, you see. And of course, the good news is that we will have infinite second chances. That's the good news. The bad news is that every time we take a second chance, it just delays it. I mean, I can imagine us in the astral world watching our life review and saying, I really don't know what that was all about. So what's it going to take for us to shorten that process whereby we can arrive at a state of soul receptivity? Because it is only through soul receptivity that we will have the hearts open to the grace that is just waiting to fill them. God is waiting to fill us with the grace, which is accompanied by the wisdom that will take us to where we need to go. And ultimately, that is bliss. So how to get that humility? Well, I was reading a book the other day. It's about the Greek Orthodox, the modern Greek Orthodox religions. A friend gave it to me. And actually, it's really very interesting, especially from a point of view of a Catholic who was brought up in the Roman Orthodoxy. But many, many things are the same. And yet there was this one story that jumped out at me, and I thought, oh, now this is gold. So the Greek Orthodox priest is handing out communion. And it, of course, communion is sacred within that tradition, as it is within the Catholic tradition. And there are all these rituals around it. And only the priest in certain, well, when I was a child, certainly could touch the wafer. So he's handing out communion, and this old man comes to receive it. And somehow, the old man lost his footing, and the communion dropped on the floor. Now, that was just cause for real deep concern and sorrow. It was a sacred moment gone awry. So the priest, feeling deeply that he didn't know quite what to do about it, obviously, what could he do about it was his thought. And he goes to his elder in confession, and he tells him the story. And the elder says, oh, he says, it's your responsibility. And the priest says, well, I didn't do it. It was an old man, and he lost his footing, and he dropped the communion wafer. And the elder said, no, he said, you were there, so it's your responsibility. And now, when I first read that, if I had read that story 30 years ago, I would have put my, it would have put my head on tilt, and I would have thought, really? But now, after all these years on the spiritual path, and having watched Swami at work, and Asha, I mean, I know if you're there, it is your responsibility. And so the priest, the elder said, for your penance, you're going to have to prostrate yourself 5,000 times. And the other fellow said, and he said, then the other fellow has to prostrate himself 5,000 times. But because we can't find him, we don't know where he is, you're going to have to do both. Now, it does befuddle the mind. What does that mean? And if you're there, it's your responsibility. How many times in our lives do we have things that come to us and we're going, really? Why me, Lord? I didn't do anything. Right? It comes, quote, out of the blue. And we don't understand the why of it. But if we're there, it's right. It's right. We're there. We're involved. We need to take a right action. And while the 5,000 prostrations were a little bit much, you have to consider the tradition. But within our own tradition, if we're there, we have to go to that place within us. And instead of looking at the other guy, the old man who dropped the communion, we have to look at ourselves and ask ourselves the question, you know, how can I correct myself? Who knows what he did to make that man tighten up enough to drop it? Who knows? Was it just a little sense of being hurried? What? Who knows? But he was there, and it was karma. And so the karma, and maybe it wasn't even this lifetime. Maybe it was another lifetime. And there's no trail, no little cookie trail in the forest that we can follow that will take us back to the cause. But the fact is that if we're there, we have to assume responsibility, and we have to muster up the humility to do that. And humility is not easy. I mean, so often we're the opposite of humility. We're trying to figure out what to do and how to arrange things so that they work for us and on and on. Whereas humility is just simple. It's what is trying to happen here? What is the highest thing that I can bring to the situation? How can I get my little self out of the way and bring in my larger self to this situation, to this person? How can I correct myself? How can I be better? And that's the only answer that's going to get us to that open-heartedness that will take us to where we really want to go. Children can do that sometimes. I think it's harder for, certainly for adults. In my own case, those moments of grace that come when we are able to do that, there is one time when that happened to me. And truly, it's never happened in that way since. So I consider it one of those miracles in life. But around 30 years ago, my life was in a shambles. Nothing was working, not financially, not in relationships, not spiritually. I was really at a desperate point where I knew something had to change. I didn't know how to make it change. But oftentimes desperation brings us to that point of humility where we can call out to God and we can say, please, Lord, help me. I don't know what to do. And so I did. And I also gave him an ultimatum, and I said, you've got 6 months. I figured I was going to do my part, God would do his part, and we'd have a happy ending. So 6 months went by, and I did my part. I really tried. And nothing happened. Humility. But 8 months came around, and I found through a long, convoluted process, I found myself at Spiritual Renewal Week at Ananda. Swami was giving the talk, Swami Kriyananda, who is the founder of Ananda. And it was on how to open the heart, which was, for me at that moment, a rather novel idea. But I was willing to listen to anything. So I stationed myself right in the front row, almost in front of Swami, and he began to speak. Now, I don't remember one word of what he said. I do remember the feeling. And I also remember very, very vividly that there was a photo of Master left of Swami, one of the big ones of Master's last smile, a few hours before he passed out of his body. And I looked at that photo and as Swami was speaking, and I became immersed. I became lost in the vibration of that photo of Master. If you look at his eyes, they're just filled with this unconditional love. There was no thought in my mind. I wasn't thinking. I was being. And in that moment, Master came into my heart. I don't really know that there are words to describe the experience, except that it was a moment of the most intense, vibrant, pure communication of love that I have ever experienced. And I wept. It was a moment of grace. And it changed my entire life. I mean, I came to Ananda, I came onto this path, and you would think, hallelujah, she made it. But no such luck. You know, when you have those moments of grace, they just give you the strength to go on to the next challenge. And it's been 30 years of challenges. Good challenges, right? Wonderful challenges. Learnings all the time. But they go back to that one moment when my heart was so open. There was no impediment, no thought, no desire. And I don't think it must have lasted more than 30 seconds. I have no idea, because there was no time. And I don't remember what Swami said. And isn't that interesting? Now, it was, I think of it as my road to Damascus. Do you remember St. Paul's story? Where Paul is committed, in those days his name was Saul, and he was committed to persecuting the Christians because he was a Pharisee, and the Christians were undermining the traditional Jewish law. So Paul's on the road to Damascus, and all of a sudden this light, blinding light, comes out and tosses him off his horse and blinds him. And he is totally bewildered and totally frightened. And he said, "Who is it?" And this voice says, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" And he says, "Who are you?" And he says, "I am he whom you are persecuting." And he said, "It is a thankless task. You should give up the goad." Now, isn't that interesting? It's a thankless task. And in that moment, Paul wasn't persuaded. It took a little while, a couple of weeks. And he went to a nearby town to recuperate, and he was blind, and he was worried, and he was just, everything that he had known had been turned on end. And Jesus sent Ananias to him, to minister to him. And Ananias is going, "Why me, Lord? He's going to kill me. He's persecuting the Christians." And Jesus said, "No, no. And he went, and he nursed him back to health, and Paul regained his sight and went on, after that moment of grace, to become one of the great early Christian saints and martyrs. But if you ever read his story, that moment when the blinding light came and when the light went into him and he saw the light, that moment was just the beginning of a lifetime filled with challenges, big challenges. He was persecuted. He was scourged. He was imprisoned. And ultimately, he was martyred. But through it all, if you read the letters and the life stories that we have available, there was this sense of joyful power, total ease with who he was, even in the face of certain death. And it wasn't egoical. It was humility at its best. Tuning into that power within that you know doesn't come from you. The first miracle Paul ever did, I forget whether it was a blind man or a leper or something, but it was a miracle and the person was really in desperate straits. And the story is, he didn't even know if he could do the miracle. You know, first it was the first time. But he prayed and he said, "Lord, you know, give me the power to help this situation." And that person got up and he was healed. But the story is not about the miracle. The story is about the receptivity of Paul, who was able in that moment to open his heart to God to receive the grace to do what he was intended to do. So humility is really the name of the game, but it's not so easy. We have to become like little children, because little children are simple. Little children do have open hearts. That is their where their compass naturally sits. And if we can do that as adults with all of the things that besiege us in our lives, all of the challenges, then we can make that breakthrough. Now, I'm certain in my own way that as I achieve old age, which I do think is an achievement, I can see patterns in my life of challenges that keep reappearing. Isn't that interesting? You think you've done it, and they keep coming back. I remember one time somebody asked Swami the question, "How do you know when it's over?" And Swami used the metaphor of the nail in the board. And he said, "You just keep pulling out, pulling out, pulling out. You never know where the end of the nail is, but eventually that nail comes out and you are free." And that was his rendition of karma in that particular moment. So I think to myself, well, where are the reinforcements? Because sometimes I'm just not enough. All my reading, all my meditation practice, all my little sacrifices that I might make is just not enough. I'm not there yet. So I open myself to Divine Mother. I mean, that's the wild card in the deck. She's always there for us, like any mother. I have a little grandchild in my life right now. He's 2 months old and he's got colic. And so he's just an angel all day long until about 6 o'clock. And then at 6 o'clock in the evening, the colic sets in and he just cries and cries and cries. And my daughter and son-in-law have tried everything. And you know what they've come up with? Now, this is a mother's love. They put that child in the car seat, and one stands on one side and the other stands on the other side, and they swing that car seat, and the motion of the car seats gives him peace. And they do that until he can go to sleep. Think about that. And Divine Mother has so much more love than we do, right? Charlie, my 3-year-old grandson, is trying to get over having his pacifier all the time. Think of all the pacifiers in our lives and how hard it is to give up those little things that bring us pleasure. And so he's 3 years old and his parents are saying, "Now, Charlie, you know, you have to do without it during the day, but at 5 o'clock at night, you can have it." And so they're weaning him, right? Well, Charlie has learned where the hands of the clock are at 5 o'clock at night. And sometimes he can wait until 5 o'clock. But this one day I was over there and he really wanted his pacifier. And his mother's trying to reason with him. Divine Mother tries to reason with us too. And she says, "Charlie, it's only 20 minutes. It's only 20 minutes. Now, a 3-year-old doesn't know how long 20 minutes is, really. But she was saying, you know, that's not a long time. And he looked at her and he just knew he wasn't going to wear her down. In that moment, she was really strong. And he said, "Mama, hold me." Now, we're no different. You know, when we don't get what it is that we need, and when we can't muster up the discipline or whatever it's going to take to go the next step, then we can always say, "Divine Mother, hold me. Heavenly Father, guide me, protect me. And saints of all religions, inspire me with the example of your life so that I can just get through this. And when we do that, that's such an act of humility that will get us to that place of receptivity where we want to be, so that grace can rush in, so we can all have our moment in the light on the road to Damascus. That's really what we want. That's really what the spiritual path is all about. And the payoff, I mean, it's so beautiful. It's bliss. Now, what is bliss? Swami tried to define it one time. And I happened to have it on my refrigerator as I was opening the door to fix dinner last night. And I said, oh, I think I could use that. But he talked about bliss in very mundane terms. He said, being in bliss is understanding that you are perfect as you are. That in this life, you are all that Divine Mother wanted, if you could but realize it. And he went on, and finally he said, you know, sometimes in the blissful state, it is such an overwhelming feeling of happiness that I cannot speak. And I know you all remember Swami, who passed away last April, but those times when he would be talking to us and he would choke up. And when he first started to do that, I didn't understand. And I got tense for him. I thought, oh, he's going to cry. And I found myself getting tense. And then I understood. And when I understood, whenever that happened, I would say to myself, Helen, you are in the presence of a person in a state of bliss. This is a gift. This is a jewel. Feel what you can of what he's experiencing. And every single time, I thought of it as grace. I thought of it as the grace of an incarnation that we, all together here, are brought to this point in this church together with like-minded souls on a path that has, at the end, the object of experiencing bliss. And in the middle, all of these things that will help us get there. And so week two, when we finally get to the end of the road, we'll be able to say, well, I don't know what that was all about, but I know this is what I'm all about.